Thank you to David Shea for sponsoring today's shiur, today's class. Le'ili Nishmas, his father, Emmanuel. What's his full Hebrew name? Menachem ben David. His neshama shavan aliyah. Thank you, David. Our story today takes us all the way back to 1859, if I'm not mistaken. 1858. It says here that the congregation Beth Israel was founded in 1858. When we say congregation, we don't mean shul, because they didn't have a minyan when they founded the shul. This is the first time I've ever seen that. Usually we're talking about a New York shul, Sheirith Israel, you know, Portland, you know, we're talking about Charleston, South Carolina, where they're like a big group of family got together. It's like, you know, we should have a shul. But you can't have a shul unless you have 10 men. And here they did not have 10 men. They had 8 men. They started a shul with 8 men. This was not one of these, like, you know, reform things already. They just wanted to have, like, a place for Jews. So they made a shul called Beth Israel. It seems like they started, I believe, meeting in the second floor of a blacksmith's store, which is how it worked back then. You know, you find somewhere to gather. It was somewhat fun to research. First, because it's a little later than we usually do. We usually do pre-Civil War stuff, and this is post-Civil War. And therefore, there's just a lot more information. But also because it's out west. And out west is like sort of the wild, wild west. Like, things were very different in the west than they were in the east. Maybe because things at this time in the east had already been sort of established as precedents. On the east coast, you know, since there was Sheirith Israel, which was around for a long time already. So things were established, how you run communities, how you run shuls. But out west, things are just sort of a little more hefker. At least that's my take of it. I'm sure it's not true, but that's how I'm looking at it. So a lot of the western communities, especially along the coast, are developed post the gold rush. I think I mentioned that last week. The gold rush in 1849 really brought a lot of these sort of satellite communities together. And the same thing was true, not because of gold per se, but because people were on that side of the country. So then, as you see here, 9 years later, they decide to create a shul. Again, 1858. And yes, I did watch a service or two of the congregation Beth Israel today. It is not what you'd expect from what was an Orthodox shul. Now it's not even close to that. Rev Dessler has an idea when it comes to working on yourself. He talks about if you're deciding whether or not you should do something, so then you've already expressed your desire. He talks about, like, if you're asking the question, should I eat a cheeseburger, so then it's clear you want to eat the cheeseburger. That's why you're asking the question. So here, a lot of the very early discussions of this shul, of this congregation, Beth Israel, were, should we be reformed? So it was only a matter of time until it actually happens. And what we're talking about today is really the breaking point, not only for this shul, but also for a lot of other congregations across America in terms of what siddur to use. You know, we hear, I don't know when Young Israel ever had to make this decision, but I'm sure at some point the Young Israel, you know, whether it was here or in Detroit, downtown, or Oak Woods, whatever it was, had to decide what siddur are we going to use? Right? What's the one that we're going to use the page numbers for? Right? When we announce the page numbers, what siddur's page numbers are we? Are we doing the Birnbaum? Are we doing the Art Scroll? Now, you know, we have the Koran Gemara, right? You have to decide that. And especially back then, when I guess it wasn't like any person could just go to their Judaica shop online and buy their favorite siddur. So back then, it was actually more important because the shul would supply the siddur. So that's really the discussion we're having today about the siddur. But we're really talking about the community and ultimately about two individuals who were at the forefront of this conflict. So here you see on this congregation's website, I was actually pleasantly surprised when I went to look. Thankfully, they all broadcast their services, so I can learn more about the shul. So I was pleasantly surprised when I saw that on their broadcasting of their services, it said Shabbat morning, 2 hours. And I 2 hours long, wow, that's a real service. So I click on the video, and, you know, people are presumably shuffling in. I don't see anybody, but you hear noise in the background. 5 minutes in, some kind of clergy, I don't know if he's the rabbi or cantor, sometimes you can't tell, starts talking and welcoming people or whatever. They start davening, you know, somewhere, you know, after 5-6 minutes. And then they daven, they do, or the person leads them in, you know, a few different songs from Pesukei Zimra and then from Shacharis. They do most of Shemona Esrei. Some of it's translated or whatever. And then after that, probably 30 minutes in. So then they're just done davening. That was the whole thing. And the speaker, he gave like a Dvar Torah, or I would probably call it like a Torah class for half an hour. And then that was it. The last hour of the video was just a video of a blank pulpit. There's nothing going on. So it was a big farce. I was hoping for like some more things to talk to you about. But at the end, the sadly interesting part of the beginning of the video was, he says, he said something along the lines of, ever since COVID, our crowds have been small unless we have a bar mitzvah, right? Our crowds are small unless there's a bar mitzvah. Now, it's one of these shul that's like a big shul, big sanctuary, and they probably have bar mitzvahs like every other week or something like that. So that's probably what he meant. People come in for the bar mitzvahs. So it was kind of sad to see, especially given some of the verbiage that they've changed. And it's obviously nothing like we do here. I'm always bothered by the performative aspect of it, but not for now. So here you find this at the beginning of their, and they have a wonderful, on the website, they have a wonderful video which gives a little bit of a snapshot of their history. And this is where I got this picture on the right from the video. I assume this is their first synagogue, this gabled roof. It says in the description of their history, it says they have, I think it's here. Congregation Beth Israel was founded in 1858 when Oregon was still part of the Oregon Territory. It wasn't even a state yet. The new Jewish congregation held religious services in Brooks Hall, which was located above a livery. How does everyone know that word? What is it? Livery. What's a livery? Livery. Oh, where they had horses. Okay.
Yeah.
Called livery because like they harvest the livers?
They must. They get their shoes fixed.
That's where they live.
Well, it's livery.
What does the word livery mean?
To live.
To live?
The stuff you put on the horse.
The stuff you put on a horse is called livery? Okay. Good. Okay. The livery stable located on First Avenue, which is now downtown Oregon. It was a horse stable. The first synagogue located at Southwest 5th and Oak Street was built in 1859.
The smells.
Great. Yeah, it's in a good Shiloh. It's nearby, but yeah. I looked up this address. Right now, it's like one of these like high risers on every corner intersections. So like, there's nothing there right now. But 1859, I believe this was in other descriptions. It says it's a gabled roof with Gothic architecture. If you look at the windows, it's Gothic for those who are familiar with the architectural terms. But so this, I only know this because that's what they put in their video. The first rabbi. This is that book that I told you that I've been using recently. I have a bunch of other books, but this one's the most dramatic. Thank you to Rabbi Eliezer Finkelman, who is now in Eretz Yisrael. I told him that we're using his books, his Torah, and he's very excited about that. So he gave me this book. This is by Rabbi I. Harold Sharfman. We used it last week also, if you remember. So he has here that early on, the Oregon, this specific congregation was pretty Orthodox. Worship was conducted in the Orthodox manner. A visitor from New York described to Reverend Samuel Meyer Isaacs, editor of the Jewish Messenger, how the services in Portland's Beth Israel were conducted in the Orthodox style, so that our correspondent fancied himself back again in Worcester Street Shul, Shari Tfila, Isaac's, you know, minister, meaning that this reminded me of home, you know, out here in Portland, Oregon, this Beth Israel, they daven just like we daven, just like Shari Tfila. So this is presumably in the early 1860s that happened, because shortly after that, things start to go awry. This is source number three is a dissertation that I found online, a very comprehensive dissertation written by a man named Robert Scott Klein. I do not know who he is, but very thorough, a couple hundred pages worth. And he wrote it in 1981, and he goes through a really an interesting history. Some of it's conjecture, which we all do because we're just trying to, you know, fit the pieces together. But he says here, in 1866, Beth Israel advertised for chazan and a teacher who, having passed examination and received his diploma in Germany, which was a very interesting caveat to put in there to put in their job description. The reason they did that is because most of the clientele, most of the congregation was German. Not an overwhelming majority, but like 60% or so. There's another, he has a chart here of the Portland population relative to the Jewish population. So you see here in 1860, it was 2,874 people in the whole of Portland. And then 135 of those were Jews. And then by 1880, which is what we're going to talk about, 17,577. So the population of Oregon itself had gone up, sixfold, I guess. Yeah, about sixfold. And the Jews, not exactly that much. More like, I guess, close. Fivefold, maybe sixfold, maybe close. But either way, the makeup, he has another chart in there, the makeup of the congregation was steadily mostly German, Prussian, German, some Polish. So when they put out their feeler in 1866, the people who were in charge of the board, right, the board of the shul, the board of directors say they want a German rabbi. To be competent to discourse and deliver lectures. The hiring of Isaac Schwab was no panacea for the ills of the congregation, right? Meaning they got this guy Schwab, sounds like a pretty German name. They got this Rabbi Schwab, and he was Orthodox German guy, but it did not help the internal struggles over congregation leadership, and the form of ritual to be followed flared at meeting after meeting, with fines levied regularly against members for disorderly conduct. Imagine if we made a couple extra bucks here and there because people came late or didn't put their talus on or whatever disorderly conduct means. So this is interesting. This individual Klein, who wrote this dissertation, was looking through all of the minutes of all the board meetings. That kind of thing I would love to have. I would just love. But he did this in Portland State University, so I assume he had access to that stuff. So I don't know why they don't publish all those things online. It would make for such good research to look at all, like what did they talk about in Beth Israel in 1866? What were the board meetings like? So he was able to look at those, and he saw here that meeting after meeting, they were arguing about all this stuff. Support for Schwab was split in 1871, which follows the general trend of the community about how many Germans are still in the shul. And when the board of directors was not disposed to rehire him on his terms, he resigned. There was an interesting back and forth. He wanted 3 years. They said 2 years. And then they countered, well, if you want 2 years, we're going to give... If you want 3 years, we're going to give you 1 year. And then they compromised on 2 years, and then he accepted the 2 years. But it turns out that the two-year vote was only once all the Germans were not present. They voted without all the Germans there. So they voted the two-year contract to present to him without against most of the people's will, and then it became a whole thing, and basically he just resigned. This is a little bit later. In this, a couple pages later in the dissertation, Beth Israel's members were the business leaders of the Jewish community. They did not uniformly support the reforms that were taking place in the congregation. My take on this is that this might be a little more revisionist history. This is a little editorializing what I'm saying, right? The fact that they did not uniformly support, I think, is a euphemism for they really didn't like, right? They did not uniformly support the reforms that were taking place in the congregation, but neither did the opponents of reform all embrace strictly traditional Judaism, right? So both sides are not really willing to compromise here.
Well, I think this is an example of, I'm not so religious, but I like my shul to be.
Right, exactly. It's sort of like the, I don't know if there's some sound background on the... So this is sort of like, there's an endearing quality to that also. Even though I'm not this, I still, appreciate that or whatever. But a lot of Israelis are like that. A lot of, non-religious Israelis, when they have their bar mitzvah, they do it Orthodox, that kind of thing. So back then it could very well be, and we'll see an example of that soon. Men like Abraham Waldman, remember that name, Abraham Waldman, a clothing retailer from Bavaria, opposed what they viewed as radical departures from Jewish principles. So he was really a staunch, conservative in lowercase, you're like a very much, you know, got to keep the tradition. While moderates like Jacob Mayer, co-founder of Fleischner Mayer and Company, we have pictures of that storefront, supported limited changes in ritual. Bernard Goldsmith, who was a close friend, characterized as a rationalist and Unitarian, espoused more radical views. Here, Lee, if you want. Espouse more radical views. We're in the middle of number three here. The philosophical differences between members came to a head during the 1870s and culminated in a bitter and violent dispute between the rabbi and conservative elements, conservative lowercase c, meaning people who wanted to keep orthodoxy. Conservatism didn't exist yet, at least in America, not in any substantial way. In 1880, Moses May, a 24-year-old reform-minded rabbi, 24 years old, got this job across the country. You thought I was young. 24 years old, was hired by Beth Israel to replace Schwab in 1872. May was described as a practical and faithful teacher who does his whole duty to his scholars and delivered sermons that were well-worded, deep, plain, I don't know what that means, deep and plain, concise, logical, fearless, progressive, and eloquent. Lots of descriptors there. You know, it almost, it sounds a little too much like doth do protest too much. Why are you giving us all these descriptors? Just say that he's a good guy. He's fearless, he's progressive, he's eloquent. But he was also a brash, uncompromising, and often tactless reformer. So this is May. Before May came, there was, I believe, I'm trying to remember, I think there was a Julius Ekman. Did I talk about Ekman last week? Julius Ekman was a rabbi that went over to San Francisco during the gold rush, and he was too liberal for the San Francisco congregation, so they kicked him out. He comes to this shul, and he was too orthodox for this congregation. He ends up, I don't know if I talk about this, if any of these sources talk about it, but at some point the shul breaks, so there's a split, obviously. A split in the 1870s, I forgot what year, around this time, 1872, 1873, something like that. They create another shul called, if you read it in English, it's called Ahave Shalom, which is not grammatically correct. I think it's Ohave Shalom, but they just, a lot of times the English names didn't correlate to the Hebrew names. Ohave Shalom, which then ultimately morphed into Neve Shalom, which is today still conservative, not reform. Got to give him some credit. But they broke off because they wanted to keep the tradition, and this Jules Ekman was their rabbi for like 8-10 years or so. So he went from this shul to the other shul because he was too orthodox. Go figures. Anyways, they replaced him with Moses May, a 24-year-old reform rabbi, as we said before. Within a year of assuming the pulpit, May demanded use of Isaac Mayer Wise's reform prayer book, Minhag America. We'll talk about that in a second. But the general rule is that they teach you at YU, don't make any changes within the first year. That's the rule. He broke the rule and he paid the price. Don't make any changes in the first year, and that's what he said. We're going to start with Minhag America. The congregation rejected the demand in 1873, but recanted a year later following a blistering letter from May in which he charged that his service to the congregation was being hindered by indifference and a lack of consistency by the members. Now, the following is I don't know if it's a ploy or he's just trying to sort of like push his agenda or whatever. I actually commiserate with some of what he's about to say. This is May's response to his shul. Hey, you guys aren't allowing me to do anything. And not only are you not allowing me to do anything, but you have no right to tell me that I can't do something. As he says here, gentlemen. This is way before. Before this. Yes, this is what probably precipitated more of the split, because he pushed this. Gentlemen, how is it possible for any minister to do good where there is such a lack of good spirit? I feel like good spirit is a euphemism here, at least for us. Maybe back then it meant like spirituality. I think that's what he's saying. It's not like he's not talking about morale. He's talking about, you know, religiosity. There's such a lack of good spirit. You have no regularity in your school nor in your synagogue, meaning you don't come. You don't come to shul. And against all my endeavors to please the congregation, I stand in the midst of a chaos of forms, and it is very difficult to discern whether to go to the right or to the left, meaning I don't know what you guys want from me because you're never here. If you guys would show up once in a while, I'd know what you want from me. But every time I try to do something, you always reject it because you say you don't want that, but I don't know what you want because you don't come. So you'll come to shul, show me what you want, and then we can do better. So he writes this letter, and somehow that worked. Somehow that worked. Okay, fine, Rabbi, do what you want. You know, you're so upset, okay, do what you want. And that's when he introduces this book, this prayer book called the Minhag America. What was Minhag America? If you look up in the Occident, as we've quoted a lot from the Occident before, that was the biggest paper of Isaac Lesser at the time, where he goes through a lot of what's going on in many different communities around America. And you look at, you just search the term, Minhag America. What you'll find is many, many articles discussing it before it ever came out. Because Isaac Meir Wise was committed to this concept all the way from the mid-40s. It didn't actually get published until 1857. But everybody knew the Minhag America. So you read these articles from the Occident, and all of it is sort of like, we don't know what it's going to say in this book, but if it says this, we'll be opposed, that kind of thing. So let's just read a little bit about this sitter, because this is at the core of what's going to happen. In 1846, Isaac Meir Wise began to plan a prayer book which was to be a liturgy appropriate to the American scene. For as he explained in the Occident, the strength of Israel is divided. This is while they were still giving him, room in his paper, because the emigrant brings his own minhag from his home. He argued that such a cause for dissension would be obviated by Minhag America, meaning you've got Germans coming in, you've got Poles coming in, you've got French coming in. Everyone's got their own Minhagim, right? Sephardis coming in from, Portuguese or whatever. So everyone's got their own Minhag. Why don't we have one Minhag? We'll all do, we'll all read from the same Art Scroll Sitter. How about that? The problem was he wasn't just making it, sort of common denominator sitter. Maybe originally, we don't know. I don't actually know. I have to do more research about this.
I once, anyway,
I mean, everyone's going to disagree. That's true. But to the extent that we can prevent it, what do you think?
I've seen this.
I'm going to quote from it soon. My point is that maybe originally, I know what you're going to say. Maybe originally he wanted it to be more traditional. Maybe, I don't know. He wanted everyone to get on the same page. Ultimately, what actually ended up happening is he made a reform sitter, which basically takes out much of the traditional values of Judaism, which we'll see in a second. But the point is that this was his, at least, original rallying cry. This was to say, let's come together. We're coming from all over Europe. We're coming from all over the world. We're coming to America. Let's make our own nusach. Why do we have to hold, why do we have to use the sitter from Poland? Why do we have to use the sitter from Germany? Let's make our own sitter. He argued that such a cause for dissension would be obviated by Minhag America. 10 years later, the Project Bear Prayer Book was published in Cincinnati in two versions, the Hebrew text plus an English or a German translation, the Hebrew paginated from right to left, the vernacular from left to right. The Hebrew title is Minhag America, Tfilot B'nei Yeshurun, which is the name of his shul. The German, you can try to read that yourself, Prayer Book for the Public and Private Worship. And the English, simply, the Daily Prayers. I put a picture of the title page on the front for those who saw that. Revised in conference, presumably refers to the 1855 conference, but maybe there's a different one also. The form of the traditional prayer book was retained, but passages which did not conform to the wants and demands of time were freely deleted. That is a euphemism if I've ever heard one. The wants and demands of time, meaning we don't want it anymore, we don't think we need it anymore, so we're going to take it out. It could be also that's not a bad conjecture, because I at least here in his book he has a whole chapter on Minhag America, and or about a bunch of pages on Minhag America. He talks about how Isaac Meir Wise at one point says something like, "You fools, you think that Yukum Por Khan is more important than keeping people in shul? You know, people are not coming to shul because of these lengthy prayers," or something like that. So yeah, it was partly not only thematic, but also just time-wise. It took a long time. Interestingly enough, I looked when I was listening to this service of Beth Israel on 3x speed, because I don't know why they say Hebrew so slowly there. Even the rabbis don't, whatever. At the end of the service, so they said Ein Kelokeinu, and they went through Baruch Elokeinu, Baruch Moshiyenu, and then they stopped there. They didn't say anything about Ketores HaSamim, which I thought was interesting, because it's a set text, but they nonetheless took it apart and changed it to remove all references to the Beis HaMikdash. And that's what you find here. If you look, anyone want to guess I want people to guess. What is the what is this piece here on the right? What is this text supposed to be? Shochein bikirbeinu Hashem Elokeinu v'ruach katshecha hofa aleinu kasher nasata osanu libris im laor goyim. Am laor goyim. Kadesh es shimcha amakti she shemecha baruch ata Hashem hanikdash banu le'enei hagayim. You think that's lo'olam? Okay. You think it's Shema Koleinu? Okay. It's kind of a generic phrasing like that, like be Hashem, be, you know, sanctified to us.
Maybe it's from the Shemoneh Esrei, because the next one has Tzimcheinu.
Good. I gave you a little hint there. So what's what before that? Okay, well, that's right. So that's the beginning of Es Semach David. Oh, I don't know if you thought that. But yeah, Es Semach David, right? So what's right before Es Semach David in Shemoneh Esrei? No, what's the bracha before it? Veli Yerushalayim. Veli Yerushalayim is right before it. This is the bracha of Veli Yerushalayim. They completely changed it. They took the whole bracha out, and they changed the whole theme. Meaning, you have to have 19 brachas. We're not going to change Shemoneh Esrei, which is very different than today. But we're not going to change Shemoneh Esrei. We still need 19 brachas. So what are we going to do? We can't put Veli Yerushalayim in there, because Veli Yerushalayim talks about going back to Yerushalayim and rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash, and we don't believe in that. This is the Minhag America that was trying to bring Jews all together. And they took out a whole bracha of Shemoneh Esrei. How is that going to bring people together? You know, it's just like, let's completely change the entirety of, you know, it was a theme of many of David. It is a very interesting theme. You know, it's sort of like, you give sort of kudos to like the lofty aspirations of that, you know. We should be some kind of good model citizens to the rest of the people here in America, that Hashem should live amongst us, and his holiness should be among within us. And just like he gave, I don't know, a covenant, Am L'Or Gayim, covenant that we should be a light to the nations, you know, sanctify his name, you know, Hanikdash Banu Le'enei Hagayim, right? The one that sanctifies us to the rest of the nations. It's a very interesting bracha on its in its own, right? I'm bringing it just to show you that he replaced Veli Yerushalayim. They took out any reference to the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, there are some phrases that they left in that that could be interpreted otherwise. So, for instance, even in the service that I listened to, they had the bracha Machzir Shchinato L'Tzion. I don't know if that's a reference to like what once happened, but we reference that to, you know, to the future, right? We think that when we say blessed is Hashem who brings his soul back to Zion, that's a reference to the Beis HaMikdash that's coming. So maybe they interpret that to mean the Beis HaMikdash that was. I don't know. But there are a couple of nuances here and there. You can go through the city. You can spend all day just looking at this thing. Yeah?
What year did these shuls separate the men and the women? They're all separate.
It's around this time. It's the different shuls happen different times. We talked about that a little last week also. In the 1850s. But different shuls sort of come around to it. Just like here, this shul is only getting around to Minhag America. The shul that we're talking about, Beth Israel, didn't really adopt the Minhag America until 1873. It was published 16 years earlier. But they just, you know, the Orthodox in the group, you know, sticks in the mud. You know, they wouldn't take on the reforms. So here in the first rabbi, Rabbi Sharfman talks about the response to this sitter. It was then that the venerable Rabbi Shachna Isaacs, he seems like a fascinating character. He came from England, but he was in Lithuania for many years. He settles in Cincinnati. I have no idea why he came to America. He wasn't a rabbi. He was just a layman who was a business guy. But he was a staunch opponent of reform. And he joins it. I forgot. He joins. He was someone else wrote a polemic against the reform years later, and they dedicated it to this individual, Shachna Isaacs. You can look up his picture and his tombstone online. Arrived from England to settle in Cincinnati, he was shown a copy of Minhag America prayer book. Horrified by its denial of fundamental Jewish beliefs, he summoned the Orthodox leaders and in their presence pronounced a ban of excommunication upon wise and all reformers. Then ceremoniously consigned the Minhag America prayer book to flames. He literally burnt it. He burnt it in front of everybody, and others followed suit. Other rabbis followed suit after he did this. They similarly burnt the book. Interestingly enough, the Occident has a couple different responses to the Minhag America. One of them written by a rabbi, I don't know if it was a rabbi, Shmuel Bruhl, Shmuel Brule did some heavy correspondence with European rabbis to sort of show the Jews in America, hey, our people in our homeland don't like, or our fatherland don't like this. You know, where all you came from? And he reached out to Rav Shlomo Shofar Hirsch. Rav Shlomo Shofar Hirsch gave a scathing critique to it. And he publishes all of this, you know, the rabbis don't like this. You know, before the ignorant Jews say, oh, another sitter for America. No, no, no. And I think people say that wise, maybe David can speak to this, wise purposefully called it Minhag America as if it was like an innocent thing. Oh, this is what Jews in America do. There's Minhag Poland, and there's Minhag Ashkenaz. Now there's Minhag America. Nothing like...
That was his whole program was, I am decreeing how Jewish life will be in America. He called his rabbinical organization the Central Conference of
American Rabbis.
It's not Reform Rabbis.
Right, right, right. Some of that is because that didn't exist yet, at least as a movement per se.
True, but I think he went beyond that. Hebrew Union College was
unionized.
Was going to be for all of America.
Right.
Everybody, his Union of American Hebrew Congregations, he was, in his view, trying to define what Judaism was in America.
And by doing so, changing Judaism, not just bring people together. Right.
Absolutely.
It was a little bit of wool over the eyes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No doubt. Minhag America, too. This is how we do it in America.
Right, right, right. So it was roundly criticized the second it came out. It was not like one of these things like, oh, I don't know, maybe.
I have seen it and perused it.
Like a physical copy? Do they still use it?
No one uses it
anymore.
It's a very, very old copy.
Yeah.
And I perused it at length. And the nicest thing I can say about it is they were later to do even worse.
Yeah, right. It wasn't as bad as it got later, yeah. Later on, the Sharfman talks about on page 428, the Orthodox in seeking to fire May, right? So this is the sitter that May introduces to the shul. He wants people to use the sitter, and he sort of pushes its way into the shul. And the Orthodox, those in the shul, who had not yet broken off into the other shul, some of them stayed back. It's kind of interesting. In seeking to fire May, accused him of referring to... Now, this was a little bit... I don't know how much of it is true, how much of it was sort of an attempt to get this rabbi out of there, but they accused him of some heavy things here. Accused him of referring to the married women of his congregation as ladies of easy virtue, which, you know, today we'd have other words for that. Back then, they were more polite when they accused people of such, horrific things. But casting aspersions upon his own wife in public, which received the condemnation of Jew, Gentile, and heathen. Heathen apparently refers to Indian. I don't know. Outrageously slandering and blackmailing several members of the congregation, condemning himself by his own actions as an immoral man and an unbeliever in the doctrines of Holy Writ, acting as a libertine and rake during a visit to San Francisco, calling the officers and members of the congregation outlandish names, threatening to join the Unitarian Church in the event Mr. Philip Selling.
This
is the Orthodox. The Orthodox people are sort of putting this claim out. This Rabbi May,
why,
he just.
Would it be upset if Philip Selling, who was Orthodox, got reelected?
No. I think what he's saying in that he was claiming that May had said, if this guy gets reelected, I'm going to the Unitarian Church. I think that's what it means. Threatening to join the Unitarian Church in the event.
They accused him of saying that, or he actually said that.
We don't know. That we can't say. But threatening to join the Unitarian Church in the event that Mr. Philip Selling, Orthodox, were reelected president. Meaning, if this guy's the president, I'm out of here. I'm going to the church. That's what he said. That's what they're claiming that he said.
I mean, reading this, it describes a very strange personality person.
Yeah, it could be. Well, first of all, this is their saying that he said it, so it's not secondhand.
If any of this is true.
Right, right, right. They don't say these accusations about you or me.
The guy's on the edge.
No,
yeah.
I think this is being misread here, because the next...
What do you mean?
Says, opening mail belonging to others for the purpose of slandering the authors of the letters. That's not them accusing her of that, because the next line is, and when he was called a liar, blackguard, scoundrel, and villain, he offered no word for his defense, but walked away. There's something...
You know, so this is them, this is the Orthodox retelling what this guy has done. we don't know if it's actually happened. They're definitely pointing to some things that happened in real life that could be corroborated, could be, you know, dismissed. But the point is that this is what they're claiming happens. He also opened email belonging to the others, the purpose of slandering the authors or the letters, when he was called a liar, blackguard, scoundrel, and villain. I don't know why they put that in, but this is what we called him. And when we called him these things, he offered no words for his defense, but walked away, and therefore gave rise to the belief that he felt himself guilty of all these charges, meaning he could have just walked away in disgust, like, I can't believe you called me that. And they took that to mean shtika koda, as we say. You didn't deny it. You didn't deny it. The reform-minded board of directors absolved May of all charges. At this point, the Germans had lost power in the shul, right? They, besides the fact that most of them left, the ones that stayed back couldn't get positions on the board anymore. So they were being outvoted. Apparently, there was a vote whether they should fire Rabbi May, this May, Moses May. Some people say it's Mayor May. That sounds a little weird. But Moses May, they put it up to a vote. And he was rehired at a vote of 28-10. I don't know who's voting, who's not voting there. It's a weird number.
This Orthodox fellow who was re-elected as president, how did that happen?
He was probably previously Orthodox president. I don't know. I actually don't know how the presidency worked back then, but somehow some of the Orthodox, I assume some of it has to do with money, if I had to guess. You know, the people that had money, the ones that... I don't know, maybe nobody else wanted. I wouldn't want to be a president of the shul.
Is this the guy who got shot?
Well, we'll talk about who's going to get shot. So if you remember, Sharfman talks about a guy, or no, the previous sources talked about a guy named Waldman, who was staunchly opposed to this, to these, you know, reforms. So here, Waldman, who apparently ran the Sunday school, in his yearly report on the Sunday school, of which he served as secretary, Waldman had written, "The progress of our school would have been more encouraging, but for the ungentlemanly conduct of Rabbi May toward both scholars and teachers." May, incensed, had gone to Waldman's clothing store, stationed himself in front of the door, and shouted, "You're a liar!" into it. Waldman had shot back that he couldn't do it in the store, meaning, you know, you bother me at my job, you know, we'll take it outside later. But at his very next opportunity, he would beat May up. This is what Waldman says to May. Now, May comes to his door because he's upset that he wrote this report about him. And May says, "Hey, you're a liar. That, you know, I'm not mistreating anybody." And Waldman responds, not now. You know, I'm doing my business here. So he said, "But the next time I have a chance, I'm going to come beat you up." That's what he says. Okay? And apparently...
They need to set out a restraining order.
Yeah, right, exactly. They need some mediator. And apparently...
Did anybody like this rabbi?
What?
Did anybody like,
presumably the reformers did.
The reform
contingent of the shul did. He was rehired. Yeah.
So you said he was rehired, but that doesn't say at the bottom of 5 that they fired him?
No.
They wanted him. They absolved May of all charges. The board was like, "Oh yeah, I know what you said, this, that, and the other thing, but we don't care." That's what they said. And apparently, this is the end of story number 6, and apparently Waldman's very next opportunity came along at 9:30 the next morning on the street directly beneath the hotel suite occupied by the President of the United States. So this is where I'm going to tell the story. The story is not on the paper. I'm going to tell the story. If anyone, actually, I printed a bunch of different copies if people want. It's just a long story. So not a long story, but I'm just going to read it out. It couldn't fit on the paper. But I'm going to pick up in this, those who do have this paper. I only have a few of them. I'm going to pick up at the bottom, towards the bottom. Okay. There's a paragraph over here that starts the climax in the struggle. The climax in the struggle between May and Waldman erupted in a fist fight and shootout beneath the window of the magnificent Esmond Hotel. I saw a picture of this hotel. It looks pretty nice, but it was a picture that was later on, so I don't know if it was what it looked like then. In the center of town, the reason why I was in front of the hotel is because, we'll see. In the center of town where President Rutherford B. Hayes was staying during his visit to Portland. Fortunately, the U.S. president was not out on Front Street that Friday morning, October 1st, 1880 at 9:30 a.m. Minister May was conversing with Isaac May, possibly a relation. I don't think so. First of all, I saw another source that said it wasn't Isaac May, it was a Levi May. So I'm not sure how much Sharfman knew about the specifics. They were not really. There was a May that was living in Portland for a long time before this. So it was probably him. But it was, the Mays, Isaac and Reverend Moses, standing beneath the suite of President Hayes, were on Front Street in the front of May's store, Hexter and May, located on the ground floor of the hotel, facing Front Street adjacent to the store of Beck and Waldman. So this guy's store underneath the hotel was across the street from Waldman's store, right? So we don't know if May was related, but the two stores always knew each other. Abraham Waldman and of Beck and Waldman, president of the synagogue, again, back to Henry's point, I don't know how he was the president at this point, probably had money, he had the store, or whatever, on Main Street. President of the synagogue approached from behind. He grabbed Minister May by the collar. This is the president. The president grabs him, pelted him in the eyes. He punched him, smashing his spectacles. The rabbi whipped out a pistol from the folds of his frock coat and shot wildly at the heart of the president of the house of Israel, meaning Beth Israel. He missed the mark, but his second shot came closer, tearing through Waldman's coat. As May reloaded, one Morris Isaacs rushed forward and restrained the rabbi before he could replace the bullets and fire a third time. Different versions were given to the press, each contestant presenting his version of the encounter. So this is the encounter on Main Street. The president comes up from behind the rabbi, and punches him in the face, breaks his glasses. The rabbi takes out a pistol from his coat and shoots at the president. Luckily, he missed. Nobody died, if anyone was hoping someone's died in here. Nobody died. But he did shoot at him twice, and he was going to shoot at him a third time. He had someone I saw online, predicted or guessed what kind of gun it was. It was a pistol that only had two chambers or something like that. Yeah, and that's why... Something like that. And he was trying to reload at the time.
So he was carrying the gun probably because he knew he was going to be beaten up.
Unclear. We don't know. We don't know why he was carrying a gun. He could just carry a gun. I know plenty of people that carry guns. Yeah.
Wild West.
It could be. It was the Wild, Wild West. Yeah.
But then Waldman didn't seem to have a gun. He would have shot back.
I guess Waldman didn't expect the rabbi to be carrying one. But yeah. This was not a duel at dawn. It wasn't one of those situations. This was a surprise attack. The Daily Standard of Portland, Oregon, I love this title, carried the story under the headline, Pastoral Relations. Pastoral Relations. And the subheadline, How Rabbi Mayer and Brother Waldman Served the Lord. This is a great headline. Back then, you didn't need punchy headlines for people to read the paper, right? People were just reading the paper. So, you could be cute with your titles. You didn't need to grab people's attention. Friday morning at 9:30, the hilarious pop, this is the paper. The hilarious pop of a little pistol was heard on Front Street. People who rushed at that direction saw that Reverend Rabbi Mayer May, or Moses May, and Mr. Abraham Waldman of Beck and Waldman engaged in a melee, which resulted something in this style. The rabbi shot twice at Waldman and tore a piece out of his coat and came near killing an honest man. And Mr. Waldman put a pair of beautiful rings about the rabbi's eyes. What's important there is that it actually happened in the other chronology, right? Waldman was the instigator there. It seems that while Rabbi May and Mr. May, this is referring to the store owner Isaac May or Levi May, of Hexter and May, were standing on the street engaged in a close conversation, Mr. Waldman walked up to them, unnoticed by either, and grabbing the rabbi by a coat collar, struck him two severe blows in the face, smashing his spectacles and injuring him severely. The rabbi then dived for this temporal ammunition and fired at Waldman twice. He was then knocked down by Mr. Morris Isaacs, and he voluntarily threw his pistol into the store of Hexter and Waldman and May. Waldman then pounced on his adversary and administered a severe castigation before they could be separated. I don't exactly know what that means. Delivered a severe castigation. But it seems like a violent diatribe of some kind. How could you shoot at me? What are you thinking? Crazy person, whatever. Waldman, a well-known and highly respected citizen, that's how he became president, which is a euphemism for he had money, right? Yeah, well-known and highly respected citizen, was arrested in the afternoon by Constable Sprague and taken before Judge Bybee and fined for assault. But as far as can be learned, Rabbi May was not molested. I think that means arrested. Waldman started it, right? And that's why he was fined, whereas May was acting in self-defense. I think that's what they decided. A reporter of the Daily Standard visited both parties and obtained their statements. This gets good. Waldman said that for a long time, trouble had been brewing in the congregation over the doings of the rabbi, who was not only deficient mentally, but also morally, and who had have long ago been kicked out of his charge, but for the sympathy which was expressed for his family. Not sure who his family, what the situation was. He added, it is reported, though I cannot vouch for its truth, that the rabbi fired at his wife one day. Indeed, the marks of the bullet can be seen in his own house. So this is Waldman saying, this guy has got a, you know, quick trigger, literally, and he will shoot at people of his own family. May told the reporter that he was called a liar by Mr. Waldman, which, as we saw, received an anonymous letter threatening that he would be killed with the same pistol which an evil and false report said he had once fired at his own wife. Right? So Waldman, somebody sent him a letter saying, hey, if you don't cut it out, I'm going to shoot you with the gun that you shot your wife. This is what May is now claiming was sent to him. He added, in religious matters, Waldman annoyed him continually, interfering with him and wishing to teach the religion of Waldman instead of that of Moses. Now that is a double entendre where he's trying to say the law of Moses, meaning me, and or the law of Moshe Rabbeinu, which is ironic because he's the one that's changing the law of Moshe Rabbeinu. But the Daily Standard doesn't know what he's talking about. So the law of Moses. And because May did not, has been trying to ruin him by setting adrift reports about moral standing, which the rabbi characterized as false, shameful, and hollow. Concerning the altercation, May said that while engaged in conversation with a friend, he was grabbed roughly from behind and received two terrible blows in his eyes. His glasses were smashed. Not knowing who assailed him, he drew his pistol and, dazed and blinded, fired in the direction of the blows. So this is his defense. I don't even know who I was shooting at. Somebody came and punched me. I pulled out my gun and I just shot. That's what he said. That's what else was. That was his. And he says, I would have killed.
In the face, though. How did he supposedly not see who it was? He punched him in the face and broke his glasses.
I guess part of it was that his glasses broke, so he couldn't see. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, he had just been threatened the day before.
Right. He probably knows who it is. The guy just told him, "I'm going to beat you up." Lo and behold, someone comes beats him up the next morning. I would have killed if I could, said the rabbi, and would have done so to even my father or brother had they treated me as this man Waldman did. Okay, a different version. The Daily Oregonian likewise reported the tale of the gun-toting rabbi and editorialized. Fortunately, neither shot took effect. Parties interfered and separated the belligerents. Reports of this confrontation between rabbi and president soon reached the eastern United States. Oh boy. The powers that be are going to hear about this. So who are the powers that be? Most importantly to Rabbi May is Isaac Meir Wise. Wise runs the ship, especially the reform movement. So what's Wise going to say about this rabbi? You know, who's now promoting his sitter in Portland Shul? Isaac Meir Wise, writing under the caption, anyone want to try that one? Verkecha? Verkerta? Velt? A topsy-turvy wool. Verkerta? Oh, fakert, like fakert. Oh, very good. A fakert world. I know it with an F. I guess it's with a V, really. A fakert welt. Noted, Mr. Waldman was not hurt. Listen to these words. It's unbelievable. Mr. Waldman was not hurt, but the rabbi was soundly thrashed for being such a poor marksman. This is what Wise said. How did you miss? As for May, Wise concluded, though not recognized as a rabbi but merely tolerated on account of relationship, as a shatz matz, a religious factotum. This is, I think, a way to put him down, being like, he's not such an important guy.
He's the only guy who's just, basically.
He's like a secretary. I looked up the word factotum. He takes care of things, like a manager. He's not a rabbi. I didn't give him smicha or anything like that. At this point, he's 30 years old. And we cannot understand how a man of a family can take his life in his own hands, especially when he knows as little how to pull a trigger as he knows of the Shulchan Aruch. They put on an epithet, you know. He knows as little how to pull a trigger as he knows the Shulchan Aruch. This is why he's talking about this, his own rabbi, you know. Yeah, you would think. Yeah, he doesn't know the Shulchan Aruch. Wise concluded, there is, of course, a vacancy in the Portland congregation, meaning this guy's out of here, right? This is what Wise is saying. And poor May will either have to go to peddling or join the Shooting Baptists. I don't know what that was. It sounds like an interesting group, but the Shooting Baptists. It is a pity that Israel should have produced a shooting clergyman, and still more a pity that the Christians in Portland believe that May is a high priest in the synagogue. wise was ungrateful. May's fray came as an immediate and direct result, right, of his attempt to introduce Wise's prayer book. And the fire, and he fired a six shooter in favor of the American way. I'm not really sure what that means.
Six bullets in the chamber.
But I thought he only had two, so I don't know. Either way.
Six shooter is a
revolver?
A revolver.
Yeah, okay. Anyways, he shot, so I guess he called it either. I don't know if he literally six shooter or whatever. The Reformed Prayer Book of America, meaning he did away with this, even though it came at a cost of reflecting bad on his sitter. This excerpt is from fine. So that's what that's the story of the rabbi that shot the president. As you can imagine, it was not long after that he was fired. Interestingly enough, they did give him his severance. I think I have a note here. $1,200. The salary was $1,000 a year. So they gave him more than a year's worth. So I don't know when his contract ran out, but they gave him a little more. May subsequently resigned his position, issuing an understated explanation, being desirous of promoting harmony in your congregation and understanding that my resignation as chazan and teacher will have a tendency in that direction. I mean, it could be that if I leave the shul, it'll be better for the shul, maybe. If the rabbi that just shot the president, you know, leaves, maybe the shul will come together a little bit more. I hereby tender my resignation. The congregation voted to give him the balance of his salary, $1,200, and he left the city. Where did he go? So I found this blog online, which is from a descendant of Rabbi May. I don't know if this is true or not, but he says here, after resigning his ministry and losing his home, Mayor May, he called him Mayor May, I think his name is Moses, but okay. Mayor May moved his family, it was in English. Mayor May moved his family to the Dales. Is that how you say that? The Dales, Oregon, for a couple of years until taking up another ill-fated position as rabbi in Waco, Texas. After initially making a good impression, Rabbi May started preaching incoherent mysticism and was referred to a physician for mental illness. I tried very hard to find any services or sermons or something like that. I couldn't find anything. The malady appears to have been temporary as his family soon returned to the Dales and then moved to San Francisco, where Mayor May established a solid reputation and career as a teacher and principal of the Free Religious School of the Jewish Educational Society of San Francisco. He found a place where he could, you know, settle down and retire.
Was he the president or is this the secretary of the...
According to the Sharfman, he was the secretary of the religious school, and he was the president of the shul. He was the secretary of one and president of the other, which is why he wrote that report, which started the whole thing. Long story short, this Rabbi May was a classical character. As you can see, this is his face. This is taken from a family picture, which has a lot of other people around. I always love analyzing these pictures. You know, what are the people wearing? What aren't they wearing? You know,
nobody smiles.
Nobody smiles.
A biological.
That's what it, I think. That's what he says. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Is he still Jewish?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I couldn't tell you. But yeah, I couldn't tell you. Either way, so a fascinating story. It is corroborated by the. The journal maybe of the president Rutherford B. Hayes has a report of what he did during that time. After this happens, he actually was on tour on the Western United States for about 60 days or so. And he was just going around the country seeing how he was. I talked to David about his presidency a little bit, and it could be this was towards the end of his presidency. David said he was elected in 1876. He was probably inaugurated in 77. So this was a few months before he left office. And he went around that same day after the shooting. He went and gave a speech to 9,000 workers at a plant somewhere. Just talking to them about American spirit, stuff like that. I mean, it didn't faze him. And that's what the journal entry talked about. Like, the shooting happened, blah, 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 but we went on our way. Yeah. He was in the hotel when it happened, but he didn't watch it, he didn't see it, he wasn't affected by it. Thankfully, he didn't go out for the morning run that morning because he might have gotten involved. But this was all under the nose of Rutherford B. Hayes, the rabbi who shot his shul president. So ultimately, the story is really about reform and changing the sitter. And being more tactful with your congregants. The postscript is the shul hired another rabbi. His name was Bloch, B-L-O-C-H. We would say that Bloch, like Elimeir Bloch. But Rabbi Bloch then took over the shul. He was reformed, but he did it in a nice way. And they ultimately just became a reformed shul. Ave Shalom was the Orthodox shul, which ultimately morphed into a conservative shul when it joined in with others. There were also... if people are familiar with this, I didn't know this. There were many fires in Portland, Oregon that really changed a lot of the landscape, not just geographically, but also sort of shuls combined. There was a fire in the 90s. There was a fire in 1923. And a lot of those shuls sort of like just joined together when they had to rebuild. So either way, you have some pictures of these old buildings, but they're no longer there.
I would think that Isaac Mayer Weiss said, I have a big, big agenda. If
right.
it gets out that
this guy, right?
Support me.
Right, right.
My
we can't have this guy on our
you
know. Right, right, right. Okay, Shkaf. What? You can't? Yeah, right. You need the shul that davens one way, the shul that davens the other way. So just another another conflict. Thank you again to David Shea for sponsoring the shiur. Elon Nishmas, his father, Menachem and David. His neshama shav and aliyah.
Thank you.
We should all be safe and peaceful with each other and with our administrators.